And we'll get going. Oral history recording on the 17th of October 2013 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist.
Tom Edlin from the History Department.
John Corsellis, Westminster.
Right, John, this is our second recording, and I wanted to take you back a bit back to Westminster School and about how you moved from Home Borders House to become a King's Scholar and your experience there.
Yes. Did I tell you why I ended up at Home Borders?
I know that you sat the challenge twice at your prep school.
That's right, yes. But I forgot to mention that there was the family connection. The two of my uncles were at Westminster. Philip Bendall and Geoffrey Bendall. And so that would have been one reason why the family was keen. And I think we actually we knew DJ Knight, I think. Is the name familiar, DJ Knight? I think he was a housemaster or a teacher at Westminster. Anyhow, and like we knew him, he could have even been at Home Borders. It's difficult when there were people talking on the phone next door. But yes.
So you started in Home Borders and then...
memorably, I was still kind of legally entitled to take the challenge a third time, once I was within the school, perfectly recognised procedure. I did so, and this is all a matter of speculation, of course, but my perception is that I was hard-working, well-behaved, conscientious, not academically that gifted, but that they felt, he's a nice little boy, and so they kind of squeezed me in the bottom place in the challenge for my year. So I ended up in college.
Was it an interesting change? So presumably you started to board.
Oh, absolutely, and a big change, of course. I mean, up till then, I'd been for some weeks, if not months, commuting from Brighton, which must have been almost a record, I should think, for the distance travelled to attend Westminster at Home Borders. We, as a family, we happened to move down to Brighton, so of course, there we are. So living in college was a big change, and I was used to boarding because I was a boarder in my prep school, so that carried with it no terrors, and in fact, it was a very tolerant and laid-back culture in the late 1930s at Westminster. I don't know what it is now.
What was the dormitory like in college at that stage?
It was the one great room, which was... Was it originally the monastic grand? No, it wasn't. A previous building had been, I think,
the first dormitory.
Monastic granary, I think.
Yes.
Over there. But this, of course, was replaced by Burlington, I think, who had connections with Christopher Wren.
Yes, that's right.
So, 18th century, perfectly normally. One massive long room, fairly high ceiling, divided up into with pretty cheap wooden panelling into 40 kind of cubicles.
Mm.
And if you were that way inclined, you could climb over the cubicle to the boy next door, or if you were a bit bolder, of course you just went through the curtain and you sneaked around that way now. And there was a degree of promiscuity. I was, on the whole, too timid and law-abiding and probably frightened of the powers of me to engage in this. Well, I think I'd have liked to have done.
Was it cold? Was it?
I don't remember being cold, but I think I have a fairly selective memory. I tend to remember, on the whole, the more pleasant things. I don't remember cold.
What about authority within the dormitory? Was it very authoritarian with the captain and the monitors?
The monitors. I don't think the captain in particular, all the monitors between them would. They would try to maintain order. Clearly, they by no means always succeeded. I think I remember doing quite a lot of reading with a torch under the bedclothes, and I think that the boy in the next cubicle to me was a chap called Wiscard, who's his elder brother, Richard Wiscard, who sadly, I think, lost his life during World War II in the army. I think he was, I think, a monitor at the time, and I was his fag, and which was involved almost nothing with the honours, but and in typical gentlemanly manner, on leaving the school, he gave me this inscribed a copy of the Oxford Book of English Verse, which I treasured and used.
A very civilised monitor.
A very civilised monitor. To me, very much a role model, kind of modest, decent, fair, all that one would hope a person in authority should be. His father, I think, was in the senior civil servant, linked with colonial administration, governor of this or that province, whatever. And I remember I was once invited to go down to their house, which was, to me, was a romantic dream. For some reason, the visit fell through, so I never got that prepared for that. Life is like that.
What sort of tasks did you have to do as a fag?
I only remember, I think that he was 1 year part of the editorial team of the Elizabethan, and I used to keep a record of our contemporaries, the other school bags that were sent on an exchange basis, and I remember compiling this with assiduity, and I probably did some other similar chores, but whether I don't remember, preparing food or drinks or doing that kind, but my memory on that isn't good. You have at least two of my contemporaries who you can still consult on this, Sir Roger Young and Dr. Michael Sweet Escott. They were both the same election or one above me there, and they may well have a better, more clear memories. Are you in touch with either of them yet?
Yes, I am. Good. They're next on the list.
Excellent.
We'll check up.
Absolutely. Very much so. And you should get a wealth of information from both of them. So you have them down in the diary, do you?
Not yet.
Not in there, but
they are on the list.
You have them on your list.
Yes.
They never will be missed. But I'm very relieved because there's also this is relevant to the photographs.
Mm.
Of course, in the 1930s in college,
yes.
We still had the Latin play, didn't
each
year. What do you remember about the Latin play as an annual event and the effect that had on your life in college?
Fair amount. I certainly was never even considered for a part. I may have been the wrong age anyhow, but I don't remember that. But I said I wasn't. But I have a soft spot for Terence and Plautus. The two Latin dramatists whose plays were produced. It was a matter of considerable excitement in my time because the only play I remember was Latin play I remember was the one which was attended by the King and Queen. And I think it was the first time that this particular King and Queen had attended a Latin play. I think the first time, in fact, probably about a century or two, that was the case. And I think I've given the school archives some memorabilia for that occasion.
Mm.
And
yes.
And actually, an invitation, but other things of that kind. It was very much of an occasion. My memory is that I think it was performed in the college dormitory.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. So they cleared one end of it, I think, half of it. It was a fairly major building operation. My mother must have been a carpentry, a maintenance unit in the school, able to do that. How you're bunked up, or whether maybe the senior boys end, I think, and I suppose they may be farmed out in some of the other houses for the period.
It must have had a very disruptive effect upon your ordinary school lives at that stage in the year.
Yes, I mean, most enjoyably, yes.
Yes. Do you remember anyone being, in any sense, annoyed about the effect it had on your work and your normal routine?
No, on the contrary. And it was the prologue, an epilogue, great fun, because they were opportunities for satire of a kind that has since Between the Walls become very much embedded in the whole BBC culture. Mm. We were already doing it, of course, Westminster, but 20 years earlier, before we had much in the way of it. This was the week that was, in the prologue and the epilogue, written by distinguished old Westminsters who were up at Oxford or Cambridge and loved showing off their classical skill and the usual puns and references to Neville Chamberlain and that. No, it was a great occasion. Thrilled to bits.
Yes, you clearly feel that you were very involved in it, even though you didn't actually appear in it. Was it very much a house event for all the scholars?
Half-life of all the scholars or all the school, I don't know. But was the cast limited to the scholars?
Generally, I think. There were a few exceptions.
I would imagine we should have produced enough talent for that, because they were quite big casts. I think it was Terence's Adelphi, I think, that we did. I only hated memories. We were all thrilled to bits. I'm sure we were roped in for doing the dream. Odd supporting activities. It was a great event. Undoubtedly, there was an awkward squad in the school, including in college. People like Richard Walheim, of course, almost par excellence, always again the government, and of course bright-eyed pupils of John Bowle, I can't think of the right word. Anyhow, among other things, trendy historian who knew everyone and brought them in to talk to the school, so that should we go on to rebels within the school or that later?
Well, why not? Yes. Why not? It's very good.
Yeah.
Was the school? Did the school feel like a place that was full of radical ideas and
yes.
debate?
Very much. Oh yes. When I arrived, of course, there was it's so difficult to distinguish between hindsight and what one thought at the time, possibly rather a stuffed shirt headmaster, a costly white, who ended up, I think, as a bishop,
dean.
But pompous and possibly losing his grip. And so I think that the governors probably pretty consciously decided, we needed a strong hand at the wheel to pull the school together after it was showing signs of falling apart under Costly White. So we got John Trail Christie, J.T. Christie, highly controversial. I rather hero worship him myself. Again, I was a very conformist, pretty immature, naive boy. I was fully carried along with his exercise of authority. Others, again, with half hours at the time or half hours later, the work of highly critical and a fairly strong anti-Christian faction around the school, arguably also rather centred around John Bowle, who was very much of a left-wing, at that time, left-wing rebel. I think a friend of Auden and Isherwood, among many others. Has anyone written a biography of John Bowen?
Not that I'm aware
of.
Not
sure they have,
no. There's not a bad entry with Wikipedia. No, it's a pretty brief one, but it's one. But I've got his biography of Henry VIII, I think it was.
Yes, yes. I have a copy of that somewhere.
Good, very readable.
Yes, yes. It's got a good style.
And he was he used to quote passages from Macaulay, among others. I read them very well, or get boys to read them. You know, a good full-blooded history. But also brought in Gerald Hurd was a friend of his, a whole range of the intelligentsia of the time, I was thoroughly aware of all this, and I was a bit of a rebel myself. Did I mention in my last interview with you the recruiting talk by the master in charge of the OTC?
Yes, you did.
Yes, good. Yes. Rebellion of a very kind of negative kind of not wanting to join the corps, the scouts were a bit too hearty for me, so ending up with doing gym, and also equally after years of boredom at prep school with soccer and cricket, found a funk hole in fencing, and of course a brilliant idea, because then there were so few fences there you could easily be a high achiever. Lucky me.
One of the best by definition.
Sorry?
One of the best by definition.
Well, not only by definition, by actuality. Public school champion in my year in foil, and second in epee. You can't get much better than that.
No, you can't.
What are the which of the other teachers stand out in your memory?
Peebles for maths. They got me up to. Additional maths for the school staff, which is not bad going. That was my ceiling. I was pretty conscious of that. I wouldn't make much fun of that, but a good solid teacher. Hillary, did he teach more so history? I forget now. But again, a very good role model, a very good, warm, decent teacher, is Mr. Hillary. Then Godfrey Barber, classics, I think, lower sixth, I think, he got his master off. He was one of the organisers of the Scouts, and himself, I think, a pacifist. I don't think he made it that obvious, but I think I was aware of the fact that he was a pacifist already at Westminster. And if I remember rightly, he was kind of eased out of the school, because just the same way as the BBC eased people out. Who are pacifists, thought not to be a very healthy idea to have influence in possibly public opinion. This was getting a bit too far up west and stuff, and so I think he left. A civilized and likeable man, D.C. Simpson, master of King Scholars, approachable and kind. I think talk classics, am I right?
Yes.
The famous teachers was G.C. Claridge, modern languages, like French and German, as he was. And also, he was school librarian, and very much a character. And I was supposed to be a running feud going on between John Bowles on one hand and G.C. Claridge on the other. And they couldn't stand each other. Is there much infighting going on in the senior common?
Well, I don't know if I should answer that. There are far more of us now. Yeah. The common room is far larger. Mm. So I suppose it dilutes the rivalries a bit.
But it's interesting how many people I can get like that. Mm. I have been renewing my memories of this. Rereading the passages from the excellent biography of Margaret Drabble's biography of
Angus Wilson.
Angus Wilson.
Yes.
It was a whole, about 10 pages or more, specifically on Westminster, going into quite considerable detail. This was 10 years before my time, but it hadn't changed that much because there were still a number of the same teachers there. I think that John Bowles features, and I think possibly Claridge too. So you have this in the library, I hope.
Oh yes,
good.
Yes.
I'm glad to hear it. Yes, Christie himself, of course, the headmaster. My memories of a really striking preacher. He really could project himself. If you were sufficiently anti-authoritarian, I'm sure it would just put your back up and cause you to become even more oppositional. I was really stirred by his muscular Christianity. Mm. He had quite the wrong effect on me that he hadn't intended I'd had pacifist leanings already almost when I joined the school, but this was increased year by year, and certainly his the version of Christianity that he purveyed in his sermons was very much what was Christ teaching, and you should try and do what he was teaching, because many of us think that Christ was clearly a pacifist. That certainly didn't fit into John Tetrell Christie's view of life. So he was deeply, not deeply shocked, but certainly disturbed that so many of his boys turned out pacifists. There were four in college, that I was so strongly aware of. William Barnes, the son of the very controversial Bishop Barnes of Birmingham, who was one of the most strongly revisionist of the Anglican bishops of the time, who had serious questions as to the divinity of Christ at all, I think, quite unlikely. And Barnes was head boy in his time, and was a striking character. He became a pacifist, joined by my old organisation, the Friends Ambulance Unit, as did Donald Swan of Flanders and Swan fame. Because again, if you want a good accounts of life, you have a copy of that in the library.
Yes,
I hope
yes.
You do. Yes. So you should. You should have more than one copy. I hope you have. But writes very well, and again extensively, both on Westminster, and of course, one can argue in some ways that the Friends Ambulance Unit was almost a logical extension of Westminster. It was not only that, but it was also a fourth contemporary man called Norman Pepin Brown, N.J.P. Brown, ended up professor of theology at University in Canada, or philosophy, but certainly a Christian philosopher. I think Catholic, and so he didn't have much of a future in England at the time, but had a perfectly respectable academic career in Canada. But he also, whether he heard of the FAU from me, I don't know, very likely. I certainly, it was I who was responsible in recruiting Donald Swan, as you remember, as he records in his memoirs. I think you should have digressed fairly successfully.
It's very interesting that John Christie, who was the first lay headmaster since Camden, is so memorable for his muscular Christianity and his preaching.
Yes. I suspect a far more effective preacher than ever his predecessor had been.
Well, I didn't want to say that myself, but yes, one gets that impression.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Yes. He was riveting. And also, of course, he was a charismatic teacher.
Mm.
Mm. I did the Antigone with him. And my goodness, that was something he really was striking there, good play. He put the fear of God in one. High standards, intolerant of poor performance. But it worked to our extent. I mean, I didn't have much of him because I wasn't bright enough to do his gospel but much. But I had a fair number of lessons with him. But most striking. I think he was one of the outstanding headmasters of Westminster. Interesting, just as a comparison. I've had considerable dealings with Winchester College, where my brother was a pupil at. Only a month or two ago, I visited there, and there met the headmaster, who was the first Roman Catholic headmaster of Winchester since the Reformation.
Yes.
Winchester, pillar of the establishment. Once lost count of how many bishops came from Winchester.
Mm.
And for them to appoint a Roman Catholic headmaster, English was his first degree, and theology his second degree. And a remarkable man, something like of the same calibre as Christie, and more of a diplomat too.
Did the boys feel that Christie was trying to change Westminster?
Oh yes, and resented it quite a bit. He wanted to introduce appreciably more rigour and discipline, and I'm sure that was resented and resisted, wanted us to be more conformist. But we were there, of course, in his early days. We predated him.
Yes. That's a source of authority.
It put us, of course, in something of a position of strength there. And the culture of the staff common room, of course, was already very strong and wasn't that easily shifted. So that the old laid-back attitude to life in general, the off-path, the native front of progressive societies over there, in the whole atmosphere there, very conscious of the Spanish Civil War, and very, we were all very pro-Republican, it was a matter of wry amusement for having Ribbentrop's son for a year or two in the school as a pupil. We were sufficiently laid back and tolerant, it didn't worry us. And then on the other side, of course, we had Tony Benn and people like Wallheim, of course, who also was very much a firebrand. Angus Wilson was before my time, but he'd been much the same culture. It was strongly non-conformist not in the religious sense, but in the wider sense. And we were very conscious also because being in Westminster, we still had the privilege of attending debates in the House of Parliament with our own place where we could go and do that. I took advantage of certainly more than once, and also we had this fairly strong and healthy kind of contempt of sportsmen. We could still produce excellence, as is shown by I wasn't the only good fencer of my time. The Pears brothers, David Pears and his elder Michael Pears, like he was, were both excellent fencers. A bit earlier, before our time, Turkey, who was an international fencer. And I think of Olympic standards, I believe. And have you got the recent book?
Yes, by Edmund Gray and Worm. It's excellent.
I've done a printout of my letter to him and making larger corrections on that. Did I send you a copy now? I don't know.
I'm not sure. Edmund's been very good about sending me corrections to the text as a whole.
In which case, the ones on me will also be out. But I had a very happy correspondence with him. I was a lot less useful than he'd hoped I would be in identifying people's faces. Mm. In my time, he was, I suppose, one of very much of the leading fencing schools. And of course, we were a pretty good water too. Mm. The dominant aristocracy in the school, as well, on the whole, was still the sporting one. I mean, they call the tune of it, but the anti-sports held their own pretty well. We had a very strong feeling of superiority over and against basically in those days. Winchester was more strongly Philistine than we were at Westminster. We looked on ourselves as being positively civilized compared to the degree of pressure on conformism. Although Winchester managed to produce a quite remarkable crop of rebels, also. We didn't do too bad because we managed Kim Philby. I was aware of his father, the Arabist. I remember, I think for the Elizabethan, I think I reviewed a book of his. It was deadly dull. I think I said so. So we managed pretty well on rebels. Maybe one comes to think of it. But also produced pillars of the establishment, like Sir William Deakin, whereby hang the tail, a very long tail.
I often get the impression that Westminster in the 1930s was particularly outward looking. Perhaps more so than at other points in its history. And you mentioned going to see debates in Parliament. Yes. And I wondered about the sort of speakers that came into the school.
Yes. I can't remember when I was there when Gandhi came. Mm. I think maybe I wasn't, but there must have been a red letter day. Poets were invited often, usually by John Boyle, Paul and Blitzok, very active. I suspect that it was Roger Young and Michael Sudeikis will remember more. The characters who came and talked to us. This is a very modest figure. Spoke well. I think Lord Adrian did, all that, of course, fully recorded in the Elizabethan, but we felt very much in the centre of things, and not cut off.
So you were talking about the dean that you remember.
Yes, that was Paul de la Billière, who then later on became, I think, suffragan bishop of Knaresborough, I think it was, bless his heart. Lovely man, and during the war, after I left Westminster, I was visiting, probably in Dean's yard, I think, and knocked into him somehow, and he basically invited me in, and I was invited to tea in the deanery, my vivid memory was of the deanery rooms all have quite low ceilings, typical old rooms, and then he took us into the gallery that the deanery has into the abbey, and suddenly going from these enclosed low ceilings out into the gallery and getting the whole majesty of the scale of the abbey, absolutely mind-boggling. I've never forgotten that. Such a privilege to have you been in that gallery?
Yes, indeed. Yes, the dean still likes to take a privileged view.
I must be a very privileged. Anyhow, just a happy memory of that. But the deans I have known, yes.
Was the abbey? It must have been a more regular part of your school life than it is for our current pupils.
Yes, well,
you were there every morning.
I'm not sure they were there every morning, but it was taken for granted. It was the school chapel, my greatest memory of the abbey was that in my time the school produced Bach's Matthew Passion, they brought in some soloists, I'm sure, who were not in the school, but particularly for all the choir the passages, the school produced the choir, I was totally incapable of singing in tune, but of course, if you're on a Bach chorale, the volume is so great that nobody really hears what you're singing. As long as 90% of them are singing in tune, to have one chap singing very wildly out of tune made no difference at all. And the marvellous feeling of taking part and singing in this superb setting. It was, really was formative to myself there. A lovely experience, a privileged one. Yes, that's probably.
And you would have been a pupil at the school when the coronation happened, but not a scholar by that point,
no,
presumably.
I was a bit out of town by myself. So that we watched the procession. There were viewing of scaffolding, I think the whole of Parliament Square, and we had a stop there. So we saw much more of it. Of course, the poor chaps did who were in the abbey. Those in the abbey, I think, those who were the senior ones, were sufficiently close to be able to see something, but the juniors right at the back didn't see a thing. Although they had that lovely experience, of course, of taking part in the library, they mainly enjoyed mixing with the peers for the hours they were waiting around before they got going at all.
And do you remember ceremonies like commemoration taking place in the abbey?
Yes, but not that well. I can't say now. You know, it'd be dishonest if I try to pretend I do. But no, one was. The abbey was a very real part of one's life, Yeah, there's nothing really to add to that. One identified quite really strongly, and I mean, I was very aware of our privileged position, and of course the easy access, because the hurdles you have to jump, and the very substantial sums of money you have to pay in order to get into the Abbey at all these days. Sadly, understandably, but very sad. And in my day, you just walked in and there you were. The royal chapels, I think, but still had to pay some very modest sum. But very much aware also of the chapter house. And of course, we the school gym, we was doing fencing over the graves of the unfortunate monks. That's where they had the area for the sick monks. This was where we used to fence. Mm-hmm. Happy thought.
Did you take all of your meals in College Hall?
As far as I can remember, yes, I think we did, yes. I don't know, the food wasn't particularly good, even before the war, let alone once the war started. But it was okay.
What sort of food, what was a typical lunch, can you remember?
No. I can't say anything useful on that, but I think no better than one would expect it to be for institutional catering in the 1930s, which was before the time of Davies and other cookery books. It was pretty undistinguished, sadly.
Did you remember there being... Were there... Did you encounter many women? I mean, presumably there was a matron?
The matron who certainly featured, and I will remember that I think it was Toscanini was conducting all the symphonies of Beethoven on the radio, and she very sweetly allowed us to listen to them in college, so she must have been quite an intellectual matron. This is my memory of matron. My other memory was that to stop me if I already had to tell you this the last time, but I suffered from appendicitis and was whipped into private hospital that was, I think, looking out on Vincent Square, the headmaster's wife, I think Lucy Christie, was very kind to come and visit me, and shared some admirable books with me. She was quite fond of 17th century literature, she broadened my knowledge of 17th century literature. My time there was not entirely misspent.
Can you tell us a bit more about your memories of being at school when the war actually broke out?
Yes. My chronology is certainly shaky, mm-hmm. but I thought it was before the war broke out that we were first evacuated.
Yes. I discovered this recently, that the school was evacuated to Lansing for the first time just before the Munich Agreement was signed. They jumped the gun and were slightly frightened.
I have happy memories of Lansing College. Certainly the scenery around Lansing, and we were shown a bit of the countryside, because bitterly cold, and fairly Spartan. And of course the very striking Lansing College, my memory with the windows with public lavatory green in the windows, light seeped through. This may be quite a mistaken memory, but I lasted that, and then we were allowed back to Westminster, I think, for a brief period, and then we were evacuated to Exeter, one of the residential colleges of Exeter University, and it was then, after that, that my mother, I think wisely, decided, although it was about a year before I would normally leave the school, I left early, so as to do something, get more practical training and experience, knowing that within a year or two I'd come to call up conscription age. And it was more useful to do that rather than staying on to the end at Westminster, because it was reckoned, quite rightly, that I wasn't likely to succeed in the competition for bursaries or scholarships at Oxford or Cambridge, without scholarship, the family couldn't have afforded me to go to Harvard University. So I left the school and was articled to a lawyer in Oxford, and with a woman with considerable foresight, a kind of godmother, paid for me to do a shorthand and typing course, so that by the age of 18 or so, I could touch type and write shorthand as fast as I could read, as I could think. Was not very fast, so all was well. The drafting, quite remarkably useful.
Within the school, I suppose both evacuations really, the sort of 1938 and then 1939, what was the atmosphere, the feeling like among the pupils being evacuated?
In my perception, very positive. It was a challenge which when one closed ranks and got on with it. We probably added to the curriculum by learning some basic first aid. It was a very good idea. We did our turn in fire watching and some other things. People, most of the boys then will be contemplating where do I go from here, many would want to do a year at university first before being called up, and then maybe they'd be called up. It brought us closer to the teachers, and there was a greater feeling of team spirit, and I think we were fairly conscious that it must have been one hell of a job for the teaching staff to cope, and also for the headmaster, when we was Westminster going to survive at all? Yeah. Somebody who was at Eton College, and who could think of commiseration, said how sad probably we've seen the last of Westminster School, and many people thought that was the case. Yeah. We wouldn't survive all. You know, it was a fairly close run thing. In fact, the school did survive, and for that, I think had a great debt to J.T. Christie, who really showed quite remarkable staying power, and J.T. Carlson too. So I didn't mention the teachers, J.D. Carlton, certainly. He was also a teacher I well remember. And liked. Yes.
Yeah. Were you, when you first arrived at Lancing, did you become integrated with Lancing College, or were you simply almost using their facilities?
I don't remember really fully on that. I felt a feeling we were kind of partly integrated. There were enough shared activities with them for that, and we didn't feel as complete interloping foreigners, took us reasonably in their stride, but I think we still did also to a substantial extent preserve our own identity. It was a bit of both.
Mm. Did any of the staff make the conscious effort to preserve the Westminster identity?
Oh yes, I was just taken for granted. I don't have clear enough memories to have any much useful say on that.
Did the school feel that war was inevitable for quite a while before it actually broke out?
I think so, yes. And there was a fairly strong consciousness of that. And we had got a number of people who were whose families were refugees from Europe. I mean, the Walheims had many family members and still in Europe. Same thing applies to Michael Hamburger and they would have helped to um, encourage us to be fully alive to the issues. And of course, people like Tony Benn was very politically active. We were pretty clear, but war was pretty well inevitable. Although, literally, the immediate euphoria when Chamberlain came back with his peace with honour, we made him partly carried away with the relief. I don't think that lasted that long. I think people were still pretty well aware.
Did you, the pupils, talk amongst yourselves about what it would mean for you personally? What choices you might have to make?
I don't remember. I suspect that I was being of an unself-assertive and lacking in self-confidence disposition, I probably kept a fairly low profile, but I think for some group I gave a talk on pacifism and the arguments put forward by people like Bertrand Russell and C.E.M. Jode and other leading thinkers of the day, and I think we knew that there were a number of pacifists there. I don't think I, at the time, had any idea that William Barnes was going to be a pacifist. I would have known, I think, that the Donald Swan was, while we were both still at Westminster. I think while we were still there, I've already met his parents and sister, and was aware.
When we last spoke, we spoke about your pacifism,
yes.
And we'd actually reached the point where you were in Orpington working as a hospital porter.
Yes.
So that's where we got up to in the story, and then I'm afraid we had to stop.
Oh, absolutely.
So
of course.
I was wondering if we could take up again.
Yes, certainly. Yes.
The story.
Well, then, my classical education, grounding in Latin and Greek, and also adequate knowledge of French and German, stood me in very good stead. After Orpington, I spent some months as a male nurse, medical orderly, in a state hospital, in the docks, Poplar. Then I only discovered a couple of months ago, reading the memoirs of another member of the Friends Ambulance Unit, that I've been to a place called Ronks Hospital, I think, in Worcestershire, where this was just the time after the invasion, the Normandy landings, and the hospital was put under great strain in coping with the number of casualties, including an appreciable number of Germans, and the other man recorded that John Corsairs, of course, spoke German, and therefore was talking, speaking with the German patients, including a young fanatical Nazi, so strong Nazi that he was refusing blood transfusions because he was feared that, his Aryan blood will be sullied, and that he had little chance of surviving. And my colleague records all this. I'd quite forgotten that I used to go in my spare time and sit with the lad, talk with him, and towards the end, before he died, he was beginning to thaw and be prepared to communicate. It was an interesting record there. Anyhow, from there I was sent to headquarters as a personal assistant to the man, a man called Robin Whitworth, old Etonian, I think, who was doing the planning for civilian relief as the British Army, or the Allied armies, were invading Europe, first Sicily and then Italy, there were going to be, of course, large numbers of refugees, and the FAU was going to help with this. And this was, to me, fascinating. I don't know, a 19 or 20-year-old, and all the policy correspondence went through my hands. And we ran what was, I think, a unique a training centre called Mount Waltham in Hampstead, a wildly unsuitable rambling house in Hampstead, where we ran 12-week training courses for people who were going to be involved in civilian relief. I didn't attend the course myself, but much of the teaching material went through my hands, so I probably learnt as much about it as those who did. Then we were sent abroad. I spent about 2 months in Egypt, one month in a refugee camp for 25,000 Yugoslav refugees from the Dalmatian coast, and we had a teams of about 8 or 10 relief workers with different specialities, and one who was served as a interpreter liaison officer. So we were working with Yugoslavs, okay, I had to, good idea to learn Slovak Croat, because also a good chance that it might be then, when Yugoslavia was liberated, go and serve in Yugoslavia. So how do you learn Slovak Croat? I was in Cairo. By chance, I found in the bookshop a book for Italians who wanted to learn Slovak Croat. I didn't speak other language, and of course, having a sound classical education, Latin, and of course French, Italian of course was childbirth, so I taught myself Italian and simultaneously Slovak Croat, and I was, you know, quickly acting as an ad hoc interpreter for Slovak Croat. Anyhow, from there went on to Italy, worked several months in refugee camps there, got completely fluent Italian, and from there went up into Austria, and turned up in Klagenfurt, the southern part of Austria, and there was a camp for about 20,000 Yugoslav refugees. Who should we send? Oh, send Corsalius. He speaks some Slovak, right? I sent on my own to join. There was a Canadian major from the civil affairs branch of the army who was responsible for a civilian camp for only about 6,000 refugees. And there were a couple of Red Cross nurses there too. Anyhow, I worked there. That was about middle of May. The fighting ended about the 8th or 9th of May. We were there shortly after the middle of May. I'd been there about 2 weeks when, in a neighbouring camp, in the next field, there were 12,000 Yugoslav refugees from Slovenia, the northern part of Yugoslavia, in uniform. They'd come over. They were part of the anti-communist, largely Catholic resistance movement that had been involved in the civil war in Slovenia, in Yugoslavia, trying to resist the communist takeover of the country. And so they wanted to be escaped. Tragically, it was decided by the army, or by the political advisor to the army, that for some good reasons, they needed to be got out of the way. They were a problem in Austria, sadly, they had quite clearly surrendered. They'd been ordered to give up their arms and had been directed by the British Army to this camp in a big field just south of Langford. And the order came then that the order was that they would be sent down to Italy, to a different camp, where they'd be safer and with more food. But in fact, the intention of the army had been to send them back to Yugoslavia under an agreement made with the Yugoslav authorities, who were, of course, our gallant allies, Marshal Tito's troops. The Yugoslav said, oh, of course, there are the few of them who are war criminals. They will be tried and dealt with accordingly, but the rest of them are quite okay. Of course, they were sent back were brutally massacred by the communists. What made it more traumatic was that in order to get the Serbian soldiers onto the trucks to drive them away, they were told, we're sending you down to Italy, you'll get better protection. And sadly, in more than one case, when the Slovenes challenged this, said, on my word of honour as a British officer, you are being sent back to Italy, you have no need to be afraid. Was an unwilling witness of what was the only major war crime which I'm aware that the British Army was guilty of during or immediately after World War II. Because under the Geneva Conventions, clearly that they had the right to protection, and that they were sent back by deceit, and also with the threats of force. In my 80s, in my 70s, I suppose, to start with, I was able to research this in more detail with the aid of grants from a couple of Quaker funds, produced a book, which was the first book to disclose in detail what happened. A previous book by Count Nikolai Tolstoy, himself a historian from Trinity College Dublin, had produced a book dealing with both the Cossacks and the Yugoslavs, but that book was quickly suppressed, and is not on sale, and in fact the copies from all public libraries and I'm ashamed to say nearly all university libraries were removed as a result of specious threats from lawyers, but my own book has been published, only a few years ago we extracted from the government a kind of an apology. The government had in fact flatly denied that this had happened on any scale for 50 years or more. It was a classic example of non-history. We had assumed it was the communists who suppressed and were the masters of non-history. Sadly, our own government was just as adept at this. But it was left to, in fact, to the present government, the Minister for Europe, I forget the name, but who he produced a blog. He invited people to send in questions as an example of open government. Very praised by it, and we raised the question with him, he clearly by implication did not challenge at all the truth of our statement, and gave reasons why he thought the matter could be, in a sense, excused, with the clear answer, he was very, very sorry that this had happened. And this was the statement he gave in his capacity of the, I think, number two in the Foreign Office. And this has been some consolation to the families of those involved, so that in one sense this can now be looked on more as a piece of past history. It's unusual in one's own lifetime to have achieved this.
Definitely. And I suppose in many ways the place that your book has had the most impact is in Slovenia itself.
Correct, yes. Thereby lies a rather charming tale. Yes, it was published also in translation in Slovenia, and we were when published we were outselling Harry Potter and the something file, what was the name, the Greek name of the best-selling book on something vile. Yeah, my mind's gone blank. Same time as Harry Potter. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah, but more interesting was that a leading Slovene writer had been wanting to write on the subject for some time, but it was so personal to them because it was the biggest tragedy that happened in history for Slovenes, with 10,000, 12,000of their most promising young men massacred like this. Then he read myself and my co-author and saw the way in, so that he has written a whole series of books based on historical themes, but in kind of semi-fictional form. He just took our book, changed the names. There are at least 12 characters that we've established in our book, all of them clearly recognisable, just given the different names, and with the hero of the book being the British aid worker, a Quaker, who was writing letters home, not to his mother but to his father in this case, so that I have ended up as the hero of this striking novel. Three or four of his books have been translated into French or German or Italian. Sadly, no one's got around to translating this particular romance into any foreign language, so that it remains hidden to the world in general, because there are not many people, apart from Slovenes, who speak the Slovene language. So I am a hero, a hidden hero.
It's interesting. You've left us speechless.
We're thinking about heroism here.
My other claim to fame, such as it is, of course, is having rescued from complete oblivion a significant poet of World War II. My brother, he was, his work was well known in his lifetime. He appears on all the major anthologies, because nobody had been really taken up since then, he'd been forgotten, and it was only entirely due to the internet that I discovered an academic, Helen Gerthaus, an English historian of ideas, and also an expert on World War II poetry. So she combined these two capacities, and I found her on the web, she agreed to look at my brother's poetry, and also his prose too, and produced this book, which is now beginning to be recognised as being of comparable significance to the better-known poets. Sidney Keys, Keith Douglas, and Alan Lewis, and Henry Reed, who before big names of World War II poetry. So I suppose would be my other claim to fame. But both of them arising in part out of my training and experience as a pupil at Westminster School.
We will get on to the Dean straight away at that poet's school.
At this stage in the interview, we generally ask if there's something you want to talk about or mention that we've not given you the chance to...
Fair point. Yes, I will have been, again, just to get on the record, one of my current interests is linked with my interest in Yugoslavia. I have mentioned that after the war, after I returned to Britain, I worked for 13 years in a body called the Educational Interchange Council, which I ran it for 10 years, which was helping to open up study visits and exchanges, first with the ex-enemy countries, Austria and then Germany, and then with the countries where there was the biggest danger that we might have a third world war with, it was the communist countries, and did a lot of work with Yugoslavia, but also Russia too, again, my experience of modern languages. It's interesting that at school I was advised not to become a specialist in modern languages. I didn't have a sufficient aptitude for that.
They were
quite right from the point of view of coping with the more academic side of French and German literature. I would not have done well on that at all. But I have since then had to work through six or seven different languages to a significant extent with Serbo Croat, Slovene, Russian, Spanish, Italian, a lot, German. I could pass for a German, and did do so. I managed to see people on that very happily, and to my great satisfaction. But Spanish also, and of course you use French widely, so that a good classical education that is probably the best preparation for anybody who has enough interest or wants to work in modern languages. In that area, I did a lot of work with Germany, and this was recognised by the award by the German government of the Order of Merit of the federal government of Germany, which I suppose is between an OBE and a CBE, but I never be able to make the slightest use of it. But there we are. It is gratifying with somebody said thank you. I did a lot of work also with Russia, which was fascinating. That gives you some idea of the range of experience.
Thank you. Wonderful.
Yeah, thank you very much.